next Thursday, July 4th?
That's a good question for Rabbi Meyer. I don't know. This is, he just asked me at 11:05 if I mind to give a class instead of him. He said apparently he's a little bit under the weather.
Oh, okay.
I say, let me think about it, I guess. I'm not going to think about it. Let's go for it. Okay.
What's your name?
My name's Rabbi Erlanger.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, I'm on staff over here. My title is Director of Community Relations and development. What that means is not for this class, but in any case, I have some profound thoughts that I could share with you. Hopefully, that will satisfy you somewhat, because I'm not stepping into Rabbi Meyer's shoes. So let us begin. What's today's date?
27.
Okay. Today's Thursday, June 27th of 2019. I wanted to fill the recording to know when it's going to be. All right. The topic I'm going to address is really a fascinating topic that, in a way, kind of captures numerous issues and numerous details that emerge through various different sections of the Torah reading of these weeks. This will be a topic that already was raised in previous week's Parsha, and I will explain the details in a moment. It will continue to this week's Parsha, and in a certain way will reach its climax in the next week's Parsha. The topic that I'm going to talk about is a subject of authority and leadership in the Jewish people, among the Jewish nation. To begin, just simply to have an understanding where the topic jumps off the pages is what may sound to us to be part of who we are, the Jewish people. At least the way it's recorded in the Torah, were big kvetchers. They kvetched a lot. They complained a lot. In fact, the whole book of Devarim, which is the fifth book of the Torah, when Moshe somewhat summarizes his tenure as a leader to the Jewish people. Can I make use of your Chumash? It will be in the... That will take some time until we get to that Parsha, called Parsha of Devarim. He will begin by summarizing his relationship with the Jewish people. And these are words, the way the commentaries explain, are words that are delivered somewhat with a tone of rebuke to the Jewish people. And he lists all the events, all the kvetching events of the last 40 years. You kvetched a lot, he tells them. From the time we, and every word, there's a verse pretty much that the simple reading of the verse doesn't have much meaning without the understanding of how the oral Torah explains the reading of the verse. It's pretty much a verse that goes like this. These are the words that Moshe spoke to the Jewish people, and then it describes where he was at the time. And it gives 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different places to explain where he is at the time. As the verse says, these are the words that Moshe spoke, these are the words of rebuke that he's going to give them. Musar is going to rebuke them for all the kvetching that was done and all the complaints that was done over the course of their 40-year relationship that they had over the last 40 years. So the verse goes like this. These are the words that Moshe spoke to Israel on the other side of the Jordan, in the desert, in a place called Arava, in a place opposite of Suf, in a place between Paran and between Tophel and Lavan and Chaseros and Dizav, the words even the simple words of the verse, it tries to give a location where he is at the time, has no meaning. You can translate that to giving even more of an there is no simple meaning of the verse besides that all the places that are mentioned is not describing where they are at the time. Rather, it is describing what is he rebuking them concerning where, concerning what. So Art Scroll, if you would only look at Art Scroll, they somehow manage to give some sense to that verse where it says, these are the words that Moses spoke to all of Israel on the other side of the Jordan concerning the wilderness, concerning the Arava, concerning the... Oh, so they somehow... I don't have a problem with Art Scroll who's trying to take the most basic commentary and make a flow, the sentence flow. Oh, so he's told, oh, these are the different places, is not a description of where he is at the time. It's a description, what are the topics about? What one does take out of that verse that I'm referring to is that they had a history of complaints. One of those complaints we read about last week in the Parsha, they're not happy with the manna. Yeah. They're not happy with the food. This week, we're going to read about the story of the spies. He's going to send the spies to the land of Israel to spy the land. And they come back and say, what are you doing to us? And where are you taking us? And we all know that engagement, or that dispute, or that tension itself caused them a tremendous delay in the desert. All these complaints, in a certain way, will climax itself next week's Parsha, which is referred to by the title of the name of the Parsha. It's called Parsha's Korach. Korach will be an individual who is going to lead a movement against leadership. It will no longer be just a kvetch, a complaint. This is going to become an entire subject. I don't know if you're aware, it's interesting to note that in Israel, ever since Passover, the reading of the Torah does not align itself. We don't, our Torah reading and the Torah reading in Israel, oh, you have been there, you missed something, didn't you? Or you heard something twice. How many weeks were you in Israel?
Three.
You were there. So I was also in Israel about a month and a half ago. It was interesting, I ended up davening in one place where they were somehow compensating for those who traveled from America, so we don't lose the reading. So it happened to be, I don't know if this is meant to be a Parsha class, even if it's not, my point is that in case you want to know why I'm also mentioning next week's Parsha, because in Israel it's this week's Parsha. Okay, so that's just a side point. So the complaint or the lack of acceptance of the leadership and the authority is somehow a topic that hovers over, you know, the bird's eye view of last week's Parsha, this week's Parsha, and next week's Parsha is the topic that he will summarize at the end of his life. You guys are a bunch of complainers. You have complained and complained and complained. One of the big ones in the parsha of Devarim that he elaborates on is actually not the story of Korach and the movement of rebellion against him, will actually be the story of the spies from this week's parsha. This is the background of the topic that I want to talk about. How are we supposed to relate as Jewish people to leadership, call it authority, positions of leadership, and what is our role as the Jewish people in terms of accepting leadership. Allow me to make a bracha. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehiyeh B'dvaroi. Thank you, whoever brought this here. So, to begin, I would say like this. We, living in a democratic society, the way we live today, we really are very, very far removed culturally from anything that has to do with authority and position and hierarchy, and let alone, we surely understand that in a democratic setting, nobody's above the law. Everyone is really, it's we elect who we want to lead us, and that person will be under scrutiny all day, all night for what they do, and either they'll survive their tenure or not. And I'm not only I'm talking about in any body of government, and even if we, my point over here is not to talk politics at all, but even talking within the role of what we refer to the role of a rabbi. A rabbi is one that we generally refer to at our own discretion and our own comfort and our own interest when we seek the involvement of a rabbi in our lives. Let's face it. When do we generally turn to a rabbi to tell us what to do or what not to do? Number one, unsolicited advice from rabbis is not the best. It's not usually received so well. Because, mind your own business. We will elect a rabbi that fits with what, more or less, we want to hear. And many times the role of the rabbis, we turn to their services in areas that we know with certainty that they have certain expertise that we may not have. So if you're going to talk about life cycle events, I understand every one of us faces those happy moments in life that we may need somebody to marry us, or we need somebody to somehow help us with a bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah of our children, and sadly, end-of-life issues, no less. I need somebody to officiate, and I don't really know what needs to be done. So there, it's not a threatening position when I turn to one who has an expertise in an area that I don't have. If I'm, as a Jew, I like to solicit that service, I need that service, I will choose usually the rabbi of whoever I consider to be my rabbi. So to us, on the receiving end, it's not a threatening position. It's not, because we will solicit his help according to, in our terms. Okay. And what happens if the rabbi will get involved in our lives in an area that we that is not welcomed, or not asked, or unsolicited? Probably different people may handle that situation differently. But ultimately, if we'll get to a point that it pushes whatever line, whatever red lines we set for ourselves, we said, this is not my rabbi anymore. This is because it doesn't align himself with my interest. So even our relationship to rabbinical authority and positions is not that, is also in a certain sense a democratic system. With that said, let's turn for a moment. I wish I could hold that clock because I only have till noon, right?
Yes.
Okay. If that is true, let's turn for a moment to the topic that has to do with something that it seems to be the core subject of all of our prayers, and that is, awaiting the arrival of the Mashiach. Awaiting the arrival, the rebuilding of the temple, and returning to Jerusalem. And all that will have to be done with a center figure. We refer to him, the Messiah, the Mashiach. Who will that be? The prophets are filled with prophesizing that moment in our time, God willing. We should experience that in our lifetime. That will be a role of Melech HaMashiach. What is he going to do? What is going to be his mission? And how will he achieve that? So this is a huge topic. I'm only focusing now on one detail. I am quoting the Rambam now. And since I don't have time, I will not even read it from the source. Please trust me that I'm quoting you an authentic source. The Rambam makes the following point. He speaks about the qualifications. He profiles what kind of an individual will be. But then he says he will do, one of the things that he will accomplish to do is force all of us. Force means against our will. That's the definition of force. Because if I'm just convincing you nicely to join me on the trip or to join me on this adventure or whatever it is, I didn't force you. Force, the word force indicates resistance, indicates a lack of interest, but you know what? I don't have a choice. Just like what we have done plenty times as parents to our children who do not want to do A, B, and C, whatever it is, whether they are refusing to do the homework, or they don't want to eat dinner, or whether they don't want to brush the teeth, or they don't want to take a shower. Whatever the situation is, each one as parents have a certain role where we will force our understanding on the kid what needs to be done with whatever. Hopefully it will be in a loving style, in a loving, but at the end of the day, there are plenty of situations as parents that we could relate where we have done that. We put our will before, and because we understand it's better for the child, of course. But the kid may be kicking and screaming, and he's not happy with that. So the word force, I just want to make clear that we use the word force, it means to say there is a resistance to my interest, to my comfort, to my ideals, to whatnot. So comes along the Rambam and says that for Jews to abide God's word and Torah and commandments is something that when he shows up, then it's democratic system is out the window in that regard. And he's going to have a mission that this Torah and Torah observance and whatever he's meant to do will be delivered by force for those who are resisting it. There will only be one method. Now, such a concept doesn't make any of us feel comfortable. We don't live in such a culture, because we have rights, we have freedom of choice, and to go have someone come and tell me that I don't have a choice in the matter, and if I just don't do A, B, and C, what the consequences would be, that's not the point of the subject right now, but just merely the fact that he's going to enforce the will of Hashem on us. The way it's referred to is that the world of the freedom, the free will that we may have at this point may fade away. It is true, truth be told, and that is just to make the subject a little bit more comfortable, is that something that has to do very much with the topic of last week's parsha, when they desired, they didn't like the man, and they wanted meat, and they wanted to have different kind of food, where the subject or the core of the understanding of the topic there has to do with the fact that at times there is a way how an individual can force a person to do something or not to do something. It doesn't have to be painful. And what I mean by that is as follows. Sometimes I could go ahead and present to you clarity, to present to you truth that you got me. I remember seeing here in Colorado, I never saw that, but I've seen horrific displays. The specific areas that I remember seeing is, if you're familiar with the East Coast, by the Outer Bridge Crossing, it's the bridge that connects Staten Island and New Jersey. Right before you want to enter the bridge, on the right side, they would have display of wrecked cars from drunk driving. And it was a display of what the car looked like. And they send a message. Should I say to the youth or to those who need it? Okay? That you see this image? You see this picture? Watch out. Interestingly, what I have seen here in Colorado, my kids, you know, here you get a license earlier than the age of 18. There was only one kid who needed to do it, so I don't remember what age it was, maybe 16. At the age of 16, you have a mandatory four-hour course, driving course. At that time, some years ago, my daughter was there, and I just went to pick her up at the end of the program. And I was there for the last 10, 15 minutes. So I figured I'll walk in, I'll hear what they have to say. And there's a movie playing. And the movie that's playing, that's exactly what they are trying to do to these kids. These are young drivers who are considering to get behind the wheel. And that was pretty, pretty horrific scenes, graphic scenes of accidents. Now, what they're trying to do, they're trying to shake that kid up and say, this is serious stuff. Now, you compel the kid to understand the risks at hand when they get behind the steering wheel under an influence. Now, let me ask you a question. Are you forcing the kid not to drink and drive? Or maybe the better word in English would be compel the kid not to drink and drive. You just present clarity with such a clear vision that you're not giving me a choice anymore. You know that. Not with these graphic displays. I hope those images or those displays help those who need it to understand that this is serious. What happens, the idea of force and compel, let's not think to ourselves only in terminology of twisting an arm. And ouch, that hurts. When an individual would have clarity, display of clarity, clarity of God, His will, and its purpose, and what it means for me and for my life and for my soul. If I will have clarity on that, yeah, you forced me to do it. You compelled me to. I understand you could use a different word for that, that is not as painful. But nevertheless, leadership is something that the nature of an individual is to resist a leadership that enters or goes beyond those lines of comfort. When that interferes with my own interest and interferes with my life. And you're telling me what yet to eat or what not to eat and where to go and where not to go and who to marry and who not to marry and all that. Mind your own business. Right? I have a life. I have a life. So when I hear that the leadership has the Mashiach is going to be such a leadership that enters that domain, how can we prepare ourselves for such type of non-democratic system? A system where we have a leader that will present itself and will compel us and will force us to live in a certain way.
Rabbi.
Yes.
On the other hand, if we did not have this clarity, wouldn't we be in the position where we are today? What is going on in Washington, and I'm sure that you've seen the picture of the father and the daughter we would be a bunch of Bildachayas. You know what a Bildachayas is?
Of course.
So of course. Somebody with a little more sense, a little more understanding, has to show to do.
Granted. But with all that, you and I have certain limitations. At what point that gets uncomfortable for me? At what point it's already my home? It's already the confinement of, I'm confining my, I understand, there are many ideals that we need leaders to tell us from right to wrong. I get it. But each one of us, at least I can speak about myself, there are certain areas that I would say, Dad, if I'm making a choice, sorry about that, if I will make a choice where to go on vacation with my kids, you could give me advice as a friend, but not force me one way or another where to go. Each one of us have certain barriers. The point that I'm here to say is that Malach HaMashiach will enter those areas, will penetrate to areas that on a given day, it's an unsolicited advice and unwelcome. With that, yeah.
So when the Messiah comes, all the Jews will go to Jerusalem, and there will be a golden age. Who's
going to
argue with that?
So, can I ask you, do you think that, okay, I can't imagine what life was like when the Jews left Egypt. I can't. But, to be at the spiritual heights that they were at the time, they were compelled to recognize God with all, you know, with their senses. This is the generation that saw Egypt turning upside down and called it 10 plagues and called it the split of the sea. And man, they are kvetching.
Yes.
Oh, they're kvetching. From the moment they left Egypt, they're coming to the sea and they're running into trouble and to discomfort and to a threat. And they go ahead and they turn it against Moses. And as they're going to move on and they will not have to lift a finger for their sustenance, and they are complaining about that. So, I don't know, but apparently we have a history.
Yes.
Apparently we have a history of resisting, of having issues with leadership. So here I have 15 minutes left to address, to explain the subject. Yeah.
What I'm interested in terms of the Kvetch is what is the psychological basis for the Jewish people kvetching. In other words, we know they did, it's well documented, but I'm really interested in knowing why are they doing that.
Okay.
Are we going to address that today?
Up the psychoanalysis of the Jews, of the people, that's what I'm here to address now.
Okay, good. You're doing great. I'm just saying.
Get it. This is what I'm
really.
So here is the core. Now I'm starting my class, okay?
Okay,
now I'm starting the class. And here is the thing that that is so fascinating. The nature of a human being, let alone us, the nature of a human being in resisting authority, resisting leadership in those zones that are unwelcome by our comfort, works in the following way. And that is, the moment I will find flaw in the leader, the moment I will find and I will be able to base my case in seeing that the leader that is interfering into my life, nishken geise tzaddik. You know what I mean? You're not a big tzaddik either. I mean, yeah. I'm not perfect. You're not perfect either. Okay?
So why should I listen?
Yeah. So, you understand, we are who we are. The nature of an individual is in resisting leadership, in resisting the interference into our comfort zone by a human being is to find flaws in the other. That gives sufficient justification why you're not the right person to tell me what to do. That is, our cycle works like that. I think there are many settings like that where that's a mechanism. It's a defense mechanism. a defense mechanism by many of us is to shrug off the individual's interference and mussar and rebuke and direction in my life is by finding faults in the other individual. The moment I find flaws, let's take precisely King David or his descendant. Imagine to yourself the King David, the Mashiach, is going to come and will preach to us the importance of purity of mind, purity of actions, how we're supposed to conduct ourselves, how we need to keep our homes pure and from any inappropriate and immoral activity. I know what comes to the mind of any individual who has some minimal knowledge of the story of King David. And I know what the person will say. King David, welcome. Welcome to the world that I live in. You know why? Because it's well documented what your challenges have been in that area exactly. I said, no, you saw a woman, you took her, she's a married woman, you sent her husband to the battlefield to try to cover the ground. So you live in my world, I live in your world. Okay, so let's together try to be better, but yeah, let's try together to improve ourselves. This is a good... It's an answer. I'm only calling it a defense mechanism when an individual who is not perfect will come to me and try to preach to me about perfection. The resistance to that can be justified when I find flaws and imperfection in the other individual. How are we to get around this? Something fascinating that I want to share with you. I don't know. This is the volume that has all the Tanakh, 24 books of the Tanakh is written here. Now I cannot tell you that I'm expert in everything here, but yes, I've studied a lot of it. There is one area. There is one book that in the Tanakh, in the 24 books, that has been a challenge in my mind for many years. There is a book called Chronicles. In Hebrew, it's called Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim is the last book of the page. The last book of the page is a book that anybody who learns it will notice that it is simply a repeat of the book of Shmuel, the book of Kings. The information in the book of Samuel and the book of Kings is somewhat repeated in most of that book. How do I know that? Number one, because I learned through it. Number two, when I needed to teach, this going back 16-17 years ago, when I taught the early prophets in Beth Jacob High School on the West Side, I studied the material very, very on a much greater measure than what I taught. You know, I needed to have an the breadth of the subject, and I taught what I chose to teach. When I learned through those books, and I learned through the commentaries, when you see on so many of the verses in the book of Kings, actually in the book of Jeremiah and also Isaiah, you see it, you try to understand. It says, oh, if you don't understand, go give a look in Chronicles over there. It's explained a little bit more. And I started finding myself flipping through the pages, learning Kings. Oh, the same thing is mentioned in the other place also. Oh, over there I get the clarity. Okay, so you're missing some information here. Pretty much, it's like one book that in my... If I would present it as a question or how it bothered me, it's almost a waste of a book. Write the first time right. You got to write the first time rather than write... especially if this is the final draft, okay? This is not the first draft. This is the final draft. So if you do a final draft and you find errors, so fix it and give me a final product. Why is there one book... And then there is another book that pretty much repeats most of the information. What do I need an extra book for? Yeah, fair question. I can't say that the other book, Chronicles, Divrei Hayom, the last one, didn't help me, because I kept on using that as a point of reference throughout the study of the book. But why is there an extra book that I would think it's a waste of ink and waste of a book? So it should be 23 books of the Bible, not 24. What do I need that last one? Okay, I'm going to have to do it very quickly.
It's fine.
Very
it's
okay. Quickly.
We're patient.
In anybody who wants to look at the sources can follow the commentary of Rashi on chapter 10, verse 1 of that book. That is, up to that point, it's called Chronicles simply because it's giving us the exact history of every generation from the time of the creation of the world, who's father and son and so on and so on. So you could really have the family tree lined up with names. And it's 9 chapters straight, just filled with names. Kind of boring. Just give a look. I mean, how many names are here? Every family and the branches of the family, and that family branched further here and further here. And you really get, if you make a family tree out of it, you could follow generation to generation until King David. And you get fully the understanding of the origin of all the and all the tribes and everything. The storyline begins in chapter 10. And the story that is mentioned in chapter 10 is actually the story at the end of the book of Shmuel regarding the fall of King Saul. I'm not here to share the details. Rashi makes the following comment over there and says like this: this entire book is written for one and only purpose. In other words, my question is addressed. Why there is an extra book? And he says like this: while we are here to learn about the fall of King Saul, without discussing the details, but once we get to King David, you will be seeing just a perfect story. The falls, the demise, the sins, nothing of King David and Bathsheba is mentioned in that book. It's not mentioned there. It's not that the Torah and the prophets try to hide the facts from us. They don't try to hide the facts from us. Because for that matter, the same way you learned the last book, you could learn the book of Shmuel, and you could learn that. And I give a class over here every Tuesday at 11:15 for women who are welcome, those who are interested, right? We study the prophets. Yes, we learn and we analyze the chapter by chapter. Yet, comes a book and there is like kind of the picture, the perfect picture book of the household of the kingdom of David. Kingdom of David is presented in a beautiful display. Anything, any fall and any sin and all that not mentioned there. Now, that's not such honest reporting. You know, you want to give me honest reporting of King David, share with me everything. Don't skip over the events that don't make him look so good. So in truth, there is honest reporting. This entire book is honest reporting. Any nuance in wrongdoing on behalf of Moshe, yeah, it's already written there. Anything that goes wrong, boom, it's there recorded. But there is a need for that last book. Because we need to train ourselves. True, King David had struggles. And the kingship of David had struggles. But we need to train ourselves that despite those struggles, we have a leadership tribe called the Household of David. And that Household of David, we need to adapt. Of course, there is a lot to learn from their mistakes. There are a lot to learn from their struggles. But there is a perspective that the end of this whole book is preparing us for that perspective of you need a leader in your life. And just to go ahead and counter the leader by finding the imperfection in that leader, and for you to shrug on all responsibilities by just saying, but you're not perfect either, that is just an excuse. That doesn't mean that he's perfect. That doesn't mean there's plenty to learn about King David and all the failings and mistakes and errors and you name it. For that reason, everything is written. When I speak about a rabbi, and that's how we started off the class. When I started off a class, yes, there is such a thing for an individual to adopt a rebbe in their life. Us in yeshiva, when I went through yeshiva, it was such an the undercurrent of everything that we learned was adopting a teacher. He gave a class, and then we had a review class about what rebbe meant. And about why did he say what he said. And if I'm not understanding properly, the entire mindset was, what am I not understanding properly? What am I missing in what he said? We would spend hours every day in deliberating what Rebbe said and what Rebbe meant, and then we would ask him. That is a mindset of accepting a Rebbe who I need to understand that, yeah, he can make mistakes, he can think wrong on a certain... But he has so much more knowledge and background than me that the starting point is I'm submitting myself to his knowledge. That doesn't mean taking myself and not thinking. We did it all the time. We challenge him all the time. But the challenge was with a perspective, Rebbe, what am I not understanding properly? This is I started off reading about Moshe. Moshe is having a lot of kvetches. Accepting leadership. Adopting a rabbi. Adopting a rav. Adopting a spiritual leader and mentor in our lives is extremely beneficial as preparing ourselves to the understanding that, yes, I have a lot to learn, and it may enter that zone that I'm not interested. So I met somebody this week, for example, I'm just going to use that as an example. I met somebody this week, and the person said, oh, today was my father's yahrzeit. So I asked the person, I'm not his rabbi, so I know I need to know my where, you know, my place. I said, no, so did you say Kaddish? So he says, no, I didn't say Kaddish for my father. He said, oh, I did call my two daughters, and I said Kaddish to them. If I would be his rabbi, it would be my place to go and tell him, what are you doing? Okay, so it needs explanation, fine. I said not to come with lashes. I get it. But the role of a rabbi, I said, no, you should go to shul at least that once a year, yahrzeit. You know what you're going to do for your father, for your mother, on the day of your yahrzeit? By saying Kaddish? You want to understand the meaning of the Kaddish? You want to understand the purpose of the Kaddish? Fine, we could learn that. We could learn that. But I'm just explaining that the role of a rabbi, of a rav, is to enter with guidance and leadership to a person how to live properly Torah life and to follow God's will in our life even beyond our comfort. And just to shrug that with excuse and say, oh, you're not perfect either, that is not an answer. And for that reason, we have a whole book presenting the clean slate of King David. So we are ready to accept the leadership of kingship of David as a leader, God willing, soon in our days. Sorry I went through. All right, the next teacher is here. What's that? Oh, you don't want me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You don't want me. Okay. Yes.